When Canada's July 1st tariffs didn't apply to MLS points, it's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, and while Nick Thornton is on vacation, Ricardo Bordalone. Ricardo, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Very excited to have you along. Ricardo was a longtime Whitecaps season ticket holder. How did you, what brought you to the Whitecaps and to MLS in North American soccer?
Literally my father carrying me into Swangard Stadium, and then I just continue going out of habit, despite how the team looked sometimes. So you'll still find me there every home game.
That's awesome. Were you at the home game on the weekend against Colorado?
I was. I very unfortunately was.
Yeah, that was tough. There were two. So in this weird period where the World Cup is still happening, but the World Cup break is now come to an end, we have like most of the MLS games on the Saturday, one on the Friday, except for two on the Sunday, both Canada Day games, both in Toronto and Vancouver. Montreal wanted theirs on, I assume Montreal wanted theirs on June 30th for reasons. both not too successful. So Tim Howard got really fired up, I hear, in the Colorado 1-0 win at Vancouver.
Yeah, that was definitely the best game he's had since he's come to the MLS. The last time the Rapids were in Vancouver, Howard basically handed the Whitecaps the win by just playing terribly. So I was looking forward to that, and unfortunately he wasn't as giving this time.
It seemed weird because I feel like his I've mentioned before the genre of angry MLS goalkeeper on a bad team, but he doesn't seem to be like to his level of play is not composed enough, is not good enough to justify the anger, kind of.
Yeah, I feel like he's still got the energy he used to have, even though he just can't pull it off anymore. So I'm not really sure what's going on there.
This comes for the Whitecaps in sort of the midst of a weird run that included that awful game against Philadelphia. And Philadelphia and Colorado are both kind of what I would consider to be beatable teams. What does this mean, I guess, in the evolution of Vancouver throughout the season?
This was one of those games where it's very frustrating to watch, and not necessarily because the team is playing poorly, but just because Colorado was so bad that losing to them is so frustrating. Like, they were just dribbling out of bounds and passing it to no one and leaving coverage all the time. We had so many chances, and although a lot of them weren't high quality chances, when you still have, I think, like 10 shots on net, you really should be able to beat a team whose only goal came off of a lucky bounce off someone's butt. Like,
yeah,
there's no reason we should have lost that game, but it was just frustrating to watch. So I'm hesitant to read too much into it in terms of the Whitecaps overall season. You know, Aja and Reyna were both gone. Watson only played 45 minutes because he picked up a groin injury. Maybe not a serious thing, probably day to day. So
is that his first game back?
Yeah. He played, I think, on Thursday or Wednesday, something like that. So, you know, he's pretty fresh, long flight back, but he looked good. And I think maybe, I don't know, being 6'7" and in a plane for 14 hours meant that his legs weren't super flexible when he got back. I don't know.
I've critiqued the Whitecaps sometimes in the big losses, like the 6-0 loss, also a little bit the 4-0 loss as being sort of like without passion, and it didn't feel like that was the case here. They certainly also had like the shots, because it was something like 25-9.
Yeah, it was absurd.
They had chances. They had a lot of possession. It's not like they weren't. It's not like they didn't have the drive to win. Just nothing seemed to land for them.
Yeah, and I saw the expected goal stats after the game, and one of the big issues for the Whitecaps were that most of their shots were pretty low opportunities. Like, they didn't have high expectations for them. And I think that's a lot that they were shooting from further out. I mean, Colorado was really parking the bus. I think they started with like a 5-4-1, so they really had no intention of going for it. I think they were just happy to pick up a point when they were going into it. And, you know, the Whitecaps tried to go through the air in that situation, which was really difficult. Colorado's center backs are very tall. So I'm just a little reluctant to criticize the Whitecaps too much for this. I mean, they definitely went with a very creative plan B based on their changes. It was sort of startling in terms of seeing Henry and Dijon at center back at some point, just the two of them. And I think... was Breck ended, or maybe Breck was taken
Breck
off.
Was,
I
don't Breck was on the field at some point, because I definitely remembered seeing him.
Yeah, I think he got taken off instead of being pushed to left back when Waston came off, which was a little surprising to me. I don't know, I think Robbo was just kind of throwing everything they had at it.
That makes sense. Was there an explanation to why Colorado's Dominic Badji wasn't around? Because that was the other thing, is that Colorado has shown the ability to beat people this year. And they also didn't seem to have that so much. Which was weird to me, because they do, they have a little bit of an attacking flow.
Yeah, I mean, Badji was someone brought in with a lot of high hopes. I don't know if that's really come to fruition, but he has definitely, you know, burned the Whitecaps, at least in the past. So it was a little surprising to not see him.
I agree with you about, like, not critiquing too much, because it's like the you, like, you can't get too, for example, you also can't get too upset over the fact that it's an own goal, because there's a bunch of, like, I think the first or second touch before it becomes an own goal isn't made, it's just a goal. So
yeah, that's true. And Rowe made a great save on that as well. So, you know, I'm not even going to criticize him on this one, where I feel like there's been a few games where I've been looking forward to Mirnović returning. But, you know, Rowe had one or two chances he had to really step up for, and he did it. Unfortunately, DeJong sort of ended up in the middle of where he shouldn't have been, and it kind of came off him. So
the Whitecaps the Whitecaps and the supporters groups had this big sort of town hall meeting. And the results on either side really couldn't have been worse in terms of supporting the Whitecaps' current thing. But it seems like people were generally open at that time about, you know, what the future plans were, and people didn't seem to be too bothered.
Yeah, I couldn't attend, unfortunately, because I was out of town. But from what I've heard, it felt productive. The relationship with the front office is improving, which is good. I think there's still a lot of hesitation about what the front office is doing in terms of player development and player acquisition. The fact that, is Breck our only designated player?
Weird.
The fact that I have no idea, and it's not obvious either, is concerning.
Yeah, like this is the thing, and I said this last week, is it's just kind of a stashing place for players that you can't damn, or just like don't want to do for the Whitecaps, which is like, you have these tools, and you don't take advantage. But the window's about to open, so we'll see what happens as players start to come in. The other team that played on Canada Day that had a rough go of it, was Toronto FC, which seems to be on the never-ending first step of its climb back up the table after a rough start, where they have a result they really could have made a win, but it's understandable why they didn't win, and then they have that game like three or four games in a row.
Yeah, people have been chalking this up to injury, and players are coming back from injury, and they don't seem to be showing any heart. I don't know if this is, you know, CONCACAF hangover, where everyone's just very burnt out this season. It might be a wash. I think the stats right now are that if Toronto finishes a season at a 2-point-a-game pace, they should make the playoffs, which is the pace they had all of last year, so that should be doable for half a season. But the way they're playing does not seem realistic whatsoever.
Yeah, they lost 1-0 against the Red Bulls. The goal came very early in the third minute the fourth minute. Kamar Lawrence, who had a great game last week as well, got a what I have is a sneaky good shot on the carpet through. I think like the everything was bunched up in the penalty area, and he was able to move everybody 5 yards to the left, which created sort of channels to send his ball through on the carpet.
Yeah, and Bono didn't look great on it. I think maybe that's one you kind of just write off. Every goalie gets some of those. You know, probably didn't see it. But when your offense can't put anything together, I mean, that can't happen.
That's what I had, is that like Sebastian Giovinco misses a penalty late on the game that was a handball call. I kind of felt that there was, like, the hand touched the ball, but the ball didn't move, so I don't know what happens at that point when
yeah, and there's a lot of evidence that the handball rule is extremely subjective already, so you know, ball to hand, hand to ball, I don't know if those things even mean anything to anyone anymore.
Yeah, I had the game on with no sound at my sort of Canada Day drinks get together, and then went back and watched the highlights later, and like 80% of the highlights were from like Marky Delgado. And I'm like, Marky Delgado can't be your top offensive player. nothing against him, but you can't rely on Marky Delgado to be the linchpin of an MLS championship defense.
Yeah, although maybe what he should be doing is taking penalty kicks, because I do not understand why Toronto continues to give Giovinco those opportunities. I think he's 2-for-7 in his most current run, which is abhorrent.
Is it like, do you think the idea is that if you can break it, like if he can break the slump, that all of a sudden like it won't be a problem anymore? Is like whenever the next one, it'll be the last, like this one will be the last one he misses?
But you don't know when that's going to be, so maybe when you aren't scoring goals and you want something to be a sure thing, just let Giovinco struggle with that on his own time, not during the game.
I feel like things like this make me wonder whether or not it's good or bad. They, unlike, for example, like the NHL, teams only come up against like penalty shootouts once a year. Because it's like, I feel like to a certain degree, after the, like, even though they won last year's MLS Cup final, there's still a little bit of a weird energy around penalties in Toronto FC. Like, you can't give that to Bradley, because Bradley also has bad energy.
Yeah. I don't know if it might even be that Giovinco has just been scouted to death by every other team. I mean, Robles is a good penalty keeper, so maybe you need to just start mixing it up.
Elsewhere in the league, on the 30th, we had a number of results that were high scoring, but I think we talked a little bit about how defenses in the league are, especially this year, have not been that organized.
No.
And so you have high scoring games, but you also have, you have ones like, and I was looking at LAFC Philadelphia, the 4-1 game, where it's like that first goal, and Diamande has been great, but that first goal, they are, the Philadelphia defense is asleep.
Yeah, they have not been a strong point whatsoever, but LAFC is just such a pleasure to watch. Just their short passes, their quick movement. And it's interesting because they don't really seem to have a plan that's anything beyond let your good players have fun out there. It's sort of like Tiki Taka, but with the MLS, so, you know, not Iniesta and Busquets doing it. But LAFC is just sort of walking around people and getting good opportunities. And Diamond is hot as nuts. Like, yeah. He is scoring a goal every half right now. I don't know how you keep him off the field like that.
Yeah, especially when Carlos Vela comes back, because he was such a linchpin at the beginning of the season. But I think that the idea of creating an offense that can, and Atlanta has done the same thing, that can rotate around two or three players, and now you have Lee Nguyen as well, that can provide something.
Yeah, and it's a little startling that they actually have depth now between Urania and Diamond. I mean, they have multiple options. When I don't think they had even 11 players signed by like February 1st this year. Like, they assemble their team as slowly as possible and have a very short bench still, in terms of like quality players at least. So I'm a little worried if they do have any injuries, but you know, as long as the ball keeps rolling like this, you know, they're going to have a home playoff game, which is nice.
I think that what is kind of something to do with it is that we've talked a little bit about defense being undervalued in the league. And if you look at the players like Betashore and Simon that have landed here, they're ones that definitely had value in Steven Betashore's case in more than one club. That like they had value that was not recognized by the club, and when the contract value got too much, they had to move on. But like, yeah, so they've sort of collected a bunch of leagues, sort of like, I know the it's the draft. There's a draft to that too, so it's not like exactly like all of the players would have been given away by the clubs. But I mean, like Betashore, basically.
Yeah, I understand Betashore went in part because he wanted to be in California for his family. So
that's true.
There was some value that LAFC could leverage in his situation. Simon, I still kind of think that was Remy Gar just being an idiot when he came to MLS. Especially with, like, they brought Simon because of facilities for Simon's kid in Montreal, and to ship him out like that, it's just, it's really rough, you know? It makes it kind of hard to like Remy Gar.
Yeah, we can talk a little bit about it later, but it's sort of like, it's been such an up and down season that every time you see him score a goal, Simon, it's like, it's just kind of like a little fuck you.
Absolutely. And I imagine not being with the Belgian national team right now is extra motivation. I think we kind of saw that with Jordi Reyna with Peru. And I mean, all things considered, like, Simon didn't have a chance really of going to the World Cup with Belgium's actual defense, but you know, he's a good defender. I think he's always kind of periphery top three defender in the league and will for a few more years.
The other thing that I thought of a lot about this game, we had sort of mirror images of goals, both LAFC's second and third goal were very similar, and also to the Philadelphia's one goal where people, where the ball sort of ricochets back to people at the top of the box who are mostly unmarked. Now, the Philadelphia one gets me also because we're recording this on Monday when Belgium-Japan happened in the World Cup. And in this Philadelphia goal happens at the very end of the first half. And I wonder if, like, every couple of years, like, the trends change and people find new, like, sort of inefficiencies in every sport. I feel like just the last 5 minutes of the half is, like, going to be the new trend. Everybody is going to start going really, like, I feel like this is possible, that everybody's going to start going really hard. This detente everyone has had to sort of, like, let off in extra time and at the very end of games is going to go away. What do you think about this possibility?
I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of the recent trend of Klopp's gegenpressing, which everyone thinks is the best way to play. And if you're a Liverpool fan, you absolutely agree. but that's leaving teams totally gassed, and that's creating that opportunity for just complete chaos in the last 5 minutes of games in extra time. I mean, the World Cup alone, there have been more goals in extra time this edition than there ever has been. So I think you're going to see that in other leagues as well, including the MLS, when teams are being asked to press very high. They're just going to leave a lot of space toward the end of each half.
You had that issue with the Toronto DC game a couple weeks ago, where it was like it had already been so bad at 2-0, and they were just like, just get to halftime, just please let halftime come. And then there was another goal even before that. No, it was 3-0. That's right.
Well, and even with that game Toronto lost 1-0 recently, where the last goal was, I think, in the last minute or maybe in added time. I mean, Toronto just switched off there, and I'm not sure if that was them being tired or if they're just kind of emotionally exhausted and can't focus for a whole 90 anymore.
Another of the, I think one of the biggest games when you look at the weekend hitting in is Seattle Portland, and this was one that had a lot of fireworks. It switched back and forth a lot. Eventually, Portland won 3-2. What did you think of this one?
It's interesting because I feel like Cascadia derbies are a little more sedate this year compared to last year, where all three were at the top of the West for most of the season. With Portland being a shell of the team they were last year after losing Nagby, they haven't really found an identity yet. The coach is trying to make that work, but they haven't really had a lot of player turnover to do it, at least in terms of new players they've brought in that have been very good. And then with Seattle, just understanding that they need to do a lot of turnover in terms of their attack, it feels like, I mean, both teams really relied on set pieces in this one. And, I don't know if they even see themselves as the teams they were the year before in terms of what they're capable of.
Yeah, I thought that like Portland a little less, but it's like Portland, Seattle, and Toronto are all engaged in this general. Well, Portland is now back, but it's like they're all engaged in this battle to sort of regain form a little bit. And Portland has done the best out of everything. And I think that you see, if there's a player that I can point to as being a part of that, it is Samuel Armenteros, who seemed to sort of activate. It also didn't hurt that Laris Maibiala, who I had not ever heard of before, seemed to have one. They seemed to have one play that tore apart the Seattle defense on three different occasions, two of which were goals. Where it's just like he scores twice, and it's the same play each time, and it's they've already even done it once before that.
Yeah, I hadn't been following Portland very closely, and I did not know who they were, frankly, until I was watching it. And I think this is what you're talking about in terms of defense, where there has been so much focus on the attacking side of the game in terms of like an overall trend worldwide that a lot of teams are forgetting about kind of having this very tight defense, having a mobile defense that can snuff out the type of plays that Portland really benefited from.
What do you think it says about Portland that they were able to get the result in this game?
I saw a crazy stat during this game, which was that it was Portland's first lead when they first scored their first goal,
Oh,
that they ever had in Seattle. And later it was the second lead they ever had in Seattle. And later again, it was the third lead they had ever had in Seattle.
no.
So,
I didn't
Portland
realize there
should
was
be
that amount of
very.
dividend, that amount of dominance.
Yeah, this is not something that usually happens. I mean, Seattle is not a welcoming place. Vancouver and Seattle have had a lot of away wins in terms of their side of the derby, but for some reason, Portland has never really been able to find success in Seattle. I don't know how much of that right now is no one is intimidated by Seattle anymore. They have a lot of clear weaknesses, and it's hard to say if this is a sign of Portland really kind of finding their paces in terms of the team they are, or more about how it's easy to figure out what Seattle is going to do. I mean, they have Nuhu who's going to overlap. You have Valero who's going to be the focal point of distribution. And if you can get two guys on him, then they're not going to have a lot of other ideas. So I think this is just indicative that until Seattle finds other ways to go at teams, no one's going to be afraid of going to the clink and taking points away.
Well, that's the thing. They've now signed the Peruvian striker Raul Ruidíaz, which is a great step, because I think that a lot of not that it would not that this would have even solved all their problems, but I think that the injury to Jordan Morris created a big sort of season issue that they didn't have any way to sort of follow up from. So that can help in terms of, like, but it's not the same. I see what you're saying about not finding a new way to play, is that, like, just adding a player is not the same as adapting.
Yeah, and a lot of Seattle fans have noted that they needed a plan B or even a plan A with Morris healthy and in the team. A lot of people don't necessarily see him as the be all end all for Seattle's attack, so this is probably just a positive in terms of their team development, realizing that they need to bring in someone else. I mean, despite their success going to the finals the last 2 years, I really think the best Seattle of recent history was with Martin.
The other thing that I thought was weird about Seattle, the Seattle in this game, is how excited everybody was for Chad Marshall.
Yeah, he's such a lovable glump. I mean, I can understand why the home fans are just like, ah, oh, yeah, that big old dude got one. It's great.
You got your goal of the year.
And he really just kind of bulldozed his way in there. Like, you could see he's just standing there, and players are throwing themselves at him, and it kind of just the ball blushes in off of the shine that comes off of his fading hair. So, like,
And he
he
throws
really
his
just.
hands up like, I did it, guys.
Yeah. It is kind of shocking that he's still with Seattle. Like, I'm very happy for him.
It's excited. It like you've got to respect the contributions of veterans to the league. Marshall has been around since 2004.
Yeah, I think he's
With
the
Columbus.
only player who predated the MLS.
That is impressive. And it through that time he hasn't, like, I get, like, that's not his contributions, it's not all in goals, but and I think it's as a defender, but it's like it's good to see a veteran around, and because I feel like, especially like the MLS 2.0 or MLS 3.0 era, whatever you would call it, the connections to the older part of the league are, like, sometimes not as easy to see. Sometimes the league is very happy to recognize Atlanta as much as it can instead. Another game, similar scoreline, also rollicking, New England DC United.
Yeah, that was a little painful to watch in terms of DC's defense. I'm sure DC's very excited about bringing in Rooney. They sh would be more excited if they were bringing in a top defender or B or C list defender.
Anyone? Anyone? And they
Yeah,
have.
because on like every goal, they were basically just standing still, in a line. They were ball watching at times. They left so much space in front of them. I don't understand how DC is going to improve until they stop making like very elementary school mistakes almost.
That first, I thought the attacking work on the Christian Pena goal was very nice. And now we had this idea that Zoltan Stieber was the one that hit the goal for DC at first, but I think Assad deflected it.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me as well. And I'm not sure how they're going to credit it, but it really seemed like the deflection was the difference there.
When you look at the Teal Bunbury goal, he is so open. He has so much space around him to work, and, like, maybe it is again that sort of end of the half thing, because the goal happens at 45 plus one, but you can't. He hasn't been turning it on every game, but I do think that New England has still has had this sort of ability to rotate around a couple of key attackers. So they have a rhythm, regardless of whether or not it's Diego Fagundes, Christian Pena, or Teal Bunbury. They're able to kind of, like, sort of change focus very fast, and it's challenging for teams to deal with.
Especially a guy like Bunbury, who has so much experience, he's going to be able to find the holes that bad defenses will leave available. So, that kind of game was really his bread and butter to find success.
There was one here, and I had it written down, starting with another team. But from the penalty on Jose Aja last week, there was kind of like the where it's just kind of like a little push, and maybe it doesn't seem like it really could knock somebody over or that it was like the biggest foul ever, but it's still a denial of an obvious goal scoring opportunity, or it's still a foul on a player that is like the last one back and has the ball. I feel like the referee is really kind of like the referees are really saying like, don't do this shit ever again.
Yeah, I'm curious too how much VAR contributes to refs maybe being more willing to call it immediately, knowing that they can call it back. But if it has to be clear that it's not a penalty, then maybe that slants a little bit to more of those becoming, you know, actual penalties and goals after that. So I'm not fully certain if, you know, is there a directive from pro so that more of these kind of things are being called? Is it VAR just giving refs a little more leeway to have confidence to call those sort of things where they didn't before? I mean, I'm in favor of it. I like players in the box having space, even if that means that, you know, they're top heavy at times and they just kind of fall over. I don't know why.
I think that VAR is having a positive effect. I kind of think that for other sort of justice related incidents like yellow cards, it's creating a little bit of a weirdness where like those are still arbitrary, but the rest of it is very specific. In this case, you have DC concede the penalty and then New England concede the penalty back the other way. Or I think it's the other way around. New England concedes to make it 3-3. This was, like you said, I think it was a solid performance, and like I do think that DC looked a little bright, you know, with Assad. They have potential on attack, but both teams were super loose in this.
Yeah, I really feel bad for Aston DC because he does not like being left out to dry, which happens pretty frequently at DC United. But yeah, going forward, they're looking pretty good. I mean, in set pieces, they're obviously being coached. It's not like nothing is happening. But until they really figure out their back line, they're just going to continue to wallow.
Another game where you saw that, and I had that in the Columbus RSL game too. That was the first one where it really reminded me of that Aja goal. In terms of would, you know, pushing in the penalty area and that sort of thing is always a little bit of a toss up, but it's like regardless of whether or not you would think of it, it gets called, and that happens on 6 minutes with Zardes taking the penalty kick to take them up. Eduardo Sosa, who is on his debut with Columbus, also scores, and Rusnak scores late in the game, but Columbus is able to hold on for the win. What do you think of Columbus at this point in the season?
You know, I had pretty low expectations at the start of the season, given the whole atmosphere around the team. So I'm pretty impressed that the front office has been making moves. I think Zardes gives them a direction that last season they didn't really have in terms of being able to be a lot more direct up the middle. They were doing so much off the wings, which was a strength, but they've really kind of focused their attack to, you know, really maximize the opportunities at the center of the pitch. So I'm impressed with what they're doing, but I still think they're outside of those top three in the East, just in terms of, you know, the finishing quality that they have. I mean, their defense isn't as tight in comparison to Atlanta or the two teams in New York, but they're definitely going to make some noise, I think, because they really don't have anything to lose, and I think a lot of players realize that there as well.
While I don't think there's any more iconic duo than Nick Raimondo and the crossbar, not a lot other than Raimondo and Rusnak is impressing me right now out of Real Salt Lake. Things have... this season they've shown sort of like some ability. They've showed some flair, but they can't too often. They haven't been able to convert results.
Yeah, do you think that's a finishing aspect, or do you think they're not creating great opportunities?
I think that they may be. When you look at it, I think that there's there were another one of the teams that's playing sort of a 4-5 or a 4-5-1 style. I think that they could maybe as much as Mike Petke knows what he's doing, I kind of feel like they could be getting more out of what they have offensively.
Yeah, and they definitely made an effort to get younger, and I think be that high-press team that's going to be really fast. And I think their defense benefits from the speed they have on defense, which is something that's very unappreciated, I think, across a lot of MLS teams, having players who can actually get back. But, yeah, it's there's still a few missing pieces, and I don't know if that's in terms of quality or just in terms of fitting everyone in where they are. It's going to be scary when Beckerman and Raimondo leave.
Another weird arcadey ball pinging everywhere game was Chicago, New York City, which Chicago won 3-2. I continue to be blown away by Alexander Katai.
Yes, absolutely.
And like, also the first thing that I did see as well is that compared to him, Nemanja Nikolic has been kind of a little bit of an afterthought. So his wonderful first goal comes in 6 minutes, where he gets the ball and goes on a nice is sprung by McCarty and has a nice break. I thought was a great way of sort of getting him back into the conversation as well.
Yeah. When Nikolic first came to the league, it felt like his form was just not realistically sustainable. So this is probably closer to what we can expect from him. And maybe that's going on with Katai right now, because he is looking incredible.
Yeah. His first ball sort of is low with pace and curve that, like, the way he hits it, it's one of those ones that is not sort of a traditional Beckham bending ball that goes up high and then comes down. It, like, travels horizontally.
Yeah. Well, I think this is really indicative of just how well he's finishing right now. You know, he's swerving the ball. It's just making it really hard for keepers, even when he's in a position that you wouldn't expect the shot to be too successful from that spot. But yeah, if he keeps connecting the ball with just the little bit of space that he's creating for himself, I mean, the way he's sidestepping defenders is just a delight to see. He's going to probably keep blowing goals into the net this way.
I've been interested to see what happens with New York with Dominic Torrent at the helm. I thought that their win last week had a lot to do with sort of... Well, I mean, it's not that... You could never know what actually was said at halftime, but just, you know, the team was much better in the second half than it was in the first half. This didn't quite happen for them this week, but I think there's a continual process of adjustment that's happening.
Yeah, this is always a really hard place for any team when you lose your coach while you're successful midseason, because the new coach isn't necessarily going to come in and clean house, which is much easier when you're trying to save a team near the bottom, or when you have the whole offseason to really get everyone onto a new philosophy. So I don't know how much he's trying to change things up. Obviously, the team isn't playing dramatically different. They have pieces that play best for what they've been doing already this year, so it wouldn't really make sense to try and change them up. But it seems like he might be trying to just ensure that there aren't too many distractions even, and can just keep playing their style.
It works out. I think one of the most surprising results of the week was Montreal beating Sporting Kansas City 2-0. It had looked like you could sort of say, well, Orlando sucks right now. They've fallen into a bit of a rut, but somehow we've been very, like, I feel like a lot of people have been impressed with Sporting Kansas City this year.
Yeah, it's funny because this was a real role reversal. Like, Kansas City has made defense what won them games for quite a few years now. And this year they've really been able to just outscore teams, which has been a little weird. Blessing has been a bit of a revelation. And Montreal has now, for the last, I think, 5 games, they have 4 shutouts. They've completely changed what their team's about. I mean, this used to be a team, right, that would win 4-3, and now they're a team that's winning 1 or 2-0. And Remy Gard, I don't know what he's done to the defense, but people are picking up assignments. They're really much more focused. Piatti's not getting as many chances, but, you know, it's still Piatti. He only needs one.
Yeah, and he was definitely able to collect. Some of the players, like, you know, I've been a little critical of a Sather Tider or a Daniel Lovitz when it goes past. Did it seem, and I think the commentators pointed this out, like, kind of Lovitz, like, inceptioned his penalty? Like not that he dove, but, like, he kind of just sort of, like put himself in the position to be fouled?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's just a very wily move. And, like, kudos to him, because, you know, you don't give the ref an option in that situation. So, I think that's, like, a very wise play on his part.
Mm-hmm. That Piatti goal is kind of almost a metaphor for the whole season Montreal-wise, because they could have let a really easy chance go away so many times. Until, like, he just roars in with, like, a fucking hurricane force kick. It's just like, okay, we're done with this now. We're not doing any more of these weird rebounds.
Yeah, exactly. That's a nice reversal to, you know, away from the ping pong goals that I feel like were a lot this weekend. But besides Piatti, I don't know how much there is going forward, which I know is troubling for Remy Gard. I mean, he'd shoot out Oduro and, like, half the team 2 months ago, and that really felt like the team was going to go off the deep end there. But he has whipped them into shape, and they're a different team now. They're about defense, and it's working for them. And as long as they have someone like Piatti, who just needs one chance, then, I mean, I think they might be able to get into the playoffs here.
Mancosa's been doing good, too. I think that it really does help to have a Tider performing and contributing. And I think that the two of them, when I've been hearing his name, it's been in these moves with Piatti, so I think they're maybe linking up together a little better.
Yeah, I mean, Mancuso just does great to be able to hold up the ball and draw players towards him. And anytime you're able to create space for Piatti, you're going to give Piatti opportunities to score goals.
Now, one thing that really scared me, and I never thought of this before, is that Evan Bush, the goalkeeper, has been such a big part of the Impact's, whatever it is, success or otherwise, this year. Their table positioning. He takes the save, and I didn't think about it until he lands the small of his back on, like, the crossbar of the goal. And the moment I saw this, I just, like, got shivers up my spine and thought, how does this not happen all the time? How is there not, like, 6 inches of padding on that fucking bottom bar?
Yeah, that was exactly my reaction. Like, I was just wincing and was like, wait, why isn't that padded? That doesn't make any sense. The NFL has, like, a whole foot of padding all around the goalposts. Like, come on.
Why? Why? And, like, I guess maybe it's just not a place people dive that often, but I was very stressed for him in that moment.
Oh, it only takes once. And it was like, what, the small of his back that landed on it? Oh, it just kind of makes your whole skin curl to watch it.
The first game of the weekend had one of the most fun pieces of news. Colin Martin, in advance of Minnesota's Pride Night, announced to his coach, his players, and himself that he is gay. Which I think is, like, the second out MLS player and the first one to come out while an active player.
Yeah, it's worked out well that an active player has come out since Robbie Rogers retired last season. So, you know, the MLS has their one person that can hold up as evidence of how great they are with the quality, even though I'm sure there are a number of players who are not out.
This is, to be honest, a great way to celebrate Pride Night. You know, a lot of teams are like, we support you, mostly. Now, did he not play? Did he not start or get... No, he didn't feature in the game.
No, he didn't, which is kind of ridiculous. When you make this, you know, they profiled him, the league was excited, it's the right day to have him there, and I mean, just put him on as a late sub, at least, right?
I hope that there is, depending on who you're talking to, they sort of estimate what a shadow percentage might be, and I hope that we see more people, that there are more people that have this announcement to make it. Unfortunately, Minnesota, I felt, had so many chances to take this game and were not able to do it, and sort of fell to a single Dallas goal that was against the run of play.
Yeah, that was super unfortunate. I mean, Minnesota finishing just really, really let them down. They had 15 shots in total, but only 5 of them were on goal, which is not great, but they looked a few of those like real sitters. I don't know if there was too much occasion that let them down. It might just be form, unfortunately, but this was a real opportunity to take points off of Dallas.
Quintero looked good. There were a lot of like sort of brick shots that were in good positions but went way above the goal. But even Ibsen, I thought Ibsen had a great chance as well. Roland Lamas took the opportunity when it was available, and this is a result, I think, as the season continues for FC Dallas, that if the ability, if they're going to go far in the playoffs, the ability to turn these sort of things will be a reason why.
Yeah, do you think this is the post-Diaz Dallas as it's going to be?
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, the one thing that's nice about it is I felt at times they can be, they can really fluctuate from week to week, and I think that the success or sort of whether or not it's Maxi or Rudy's game can have a big thing to do with that. So the fact that they win and he doesn't score in this game, I think is a positive. Because if you're, you know, if you're spreading the wealth around a little bit, that can only help them, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. They do have a few different options in terms of how they want to fill Diaz's hole. But it's troubling because last season the team really turned on Diaz's form or whether he was playing in terms of his injury. So the fact that they were able to get an away win, you know, in this situation, I really feel like Dallas is going to, their season is going to be defined by how they respond to the loss of Diaz. Since they got this away result, I mean, this is promising. Lama can definitely, he's just such a good aerial header. I saw a while back kind of this illustration of how you have three types of headers, you know, your ability to head in the air, how tall you are, and how high you can jump. And like, he isn't the tallest guy necessarily. He's not Waston, but when he had just a little bit of space, he really made the most of it.
Absolutely. I think what Dallas needs is more Tesho Akindele.
Oh, I mean, I am a big fan, just in terms of the Canadian connection. But, yes. You know, he loves to run, and he's got great pace with the ball, and it's fun to watch Dallas play that way. So, really, the more they use them, then the happier I think a neutral is going to be.
Another key, and this is that we started to talk about, you were talking earlier about teams that score 3 and give up 3. That is the LA Galaxy this year in what was termed as the 7th Cali Classico, or teams that give up as much as they score. It was a 3-3 draw. All three goals from LA were beautiful. Two of them by Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Another one that was a beautiful free kick goal from Alessandrini at a wide angle. But I felt that there was just so much. Like, there was the Bradford Jameson challenge for a penalty. There was just he's not really his defensive noose is not the biggest, but like you definitely, I think, saw the defensive side is not keeping up to the rest of LA Galaxy.
Yeah, I felt kind of bad for San Jose, since, I mean, Wando had a great chance right there at the end, and they really deserved the win here, because Galaxy were only in this because of Ibrahimovic and Alessandrini, and that's, you know, a way to build a team, just have two really great players and make sure that they are going to bury chances like that, and, I mean, they are incredible finishers, so that's not a terrible idea when you have both of them. But, yeah, Galaxy's defense certainly didn't look as good as San Jose's, and San Jose does not have good defense, per se. So the fact that Galaxy didn't have that many chances, and that's promising in terms of San Jose, but, yeah, they really need to... LA really needs to get buy-in in terms of tracking back and... You know, if you're going to commit a tactical foul, do it outside the box. Come on, Jameson. Like, what you doing?
Now, okay, so Bradford Jameson, I did find it out. It was just a yellow. The other one was later on when Houston got pulled down, which I feel like he's been really the light for San Jose this year. You're absolutely right. Is that it's not like San Jose's defense was any better.
No, and they've definitely just left spaces between the lines, so if a guy like Ibrahimovic can pick it up, he can bury it, but, you know, most teams don't have guys like Ibrahimovic, so they are going to be okay, I think, San Jose, if they keep going this way. They're still going to be allowing, like, 3 goals per game, but they're getting a little bit better, at least in terms of picking up players and maintaining their line.
Now, the last game of the weekend, and we talked a little bit about Orlando and its past follies, but things are not looking any better for them against Atlanta, as Atlanta just sort of took them apart 4-0, as we've seen them do at home to teams multiple times this year.
Yeah, I really felt like the score flattered Atlanta a little bit, because they really made the most of the chances they had. I mean, Orlando did not deserve to be in this. And I think the goals they gave up were really indicative of how Orlando does not have a mobile defense. I mean, Spectre, he's got a good understanding of space and that sort of things, but as soon as you're by him, he's not going to catch up. And they're indicative of what happens to teams who have slow defenders. They'll get caught out, and if neither of them can... you know, cover the space behind through their speed, like, a team like Atlanta is just going to devastate you.
We had Julian Gressel, who was not added to the All-Star team, Fan 11, with so many of his Atlanta teammates, again, sort of create a goal with a long looping ball to Josep Martinez. And then we saw Martinez feed for Almiron, which I think was followed up with a Dragon Ball Z style fusion dance.
Yeah, people, I think, look forward to his dancing, which is fantastic.
They're having fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's only so many players from Atlanta I think they could put on the team, as much as their fans tried. Speaking of the All-Star game, very happy to see that Davey's gone in there. I mean, I love the commissioner picks, because they're obviously just the picks where the league is like, come on, you cannot have an All-Star game without the player who's going to Europe next year.
Please.
Yeah, so that's... I like the commissioner's picks. I like that in terms of just like, no, you guys, we need to have this person.
I don't know how Alexander Katai did not make the cut. For Orlando, they did hire a new coach. It was the former manager of Louisville City in the USL, James O'Connor, who played for Orlando when Orlando was in USL. Do you think that this pick works? They kind of, I feel like Jason Kreis has sometimes been cast as sort of a star management hire that has had little luck outside of his star-making performance in RSL. Do you think that they sort of, by picking a lower-profile candidate, they went well?
Yeah, I don't know, in the end, why Christ was so unsuccessful this year. They made a lot of positive changes. They brought in players who seemed they would fit with Christ's preferred style really well. So I'm not sure if it's just that they were hung out to dry by their defense too often. And in terms of that, I don't know how a new coach is going to be able to improve it too much without either really changing the philosophy of the team, which, you know, he hasn't done yet, obviously, or without bringing in a bunch of new guys. So I don't know whether his stature is necessarily a positive in terms of his hire. I was excited, honestly, when Chris got hired, because I think that's a team that deserves to have success. So they've got great fans, and, you know, it'd be good for there to be someone opposing Atlanta in that area, create a bit more of a rivalry rather than just Atlanta walking all over Orlando.
But you're right. It's weird. It's almost weird to think of them as a pushover at this point in the schedule.
Yeah, people keep pushing it that way, but it's not really. I do think that Orlando's coach will benefit from knowing the team really well and being able to be very frank in terms of the quality of players that are not coming in as stars, because he'll really have that angle understood well.
All this done, who was your team of the week?
I'd say LAFC. They looked great. They just can dance around teams right now, and I think they're going to be successful in the playoffs, honestly.
I'm going to go with Montreal just because I'm so... I find it so strange that they're continuing to have this amount of success. And my goal of the week is going to be Alexander Tatai's first goal against New York.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I'm going to go with Ibrahimovic's first goal, where he hit it with the outside of his foot and just swerved past Bingham. I just love those outside of the foot goals.
They're so hot right now.
They look so nice. Just the way they totally elude keepers.
Until next week, where can we find you online?
You should check me out on Peach. You can, if you don't have it, go to peach.cool to download Peach. And I am Ricardo B. So go look for me there.
You can find me at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. I'm editor at Howler Magazine, whatahowler.com. You can find this podcast at thatsomls.com on Twitter, on iTunes, and wherever your podcast can be found. Please rate, review, and subscribe. When Nick has returned from Cuba, you can find him at thatsomls on Twitter. And until next week, don't get sent off for giving someone a little push.
Yeah, and maybe don't push people in the box.